nice tea. Okay. So set A is what? Odd and even numbers, and it's an infinite set. Set B is starting with 1. Set B starts with 1, but it's just odd numbers, and it's an infinite set. Set C only has multiples of 10. 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, but it goes on and on. It's an infinite set. Now, the thing is, if these exist outside the mind, okay, in the concrete realm, then you would have contradictions, because set B is half the size of set A, yet they're both equal because they're both infinite. You see how that would be a contradiction? You're having A equals non-A is what it amounts to. Set C is 10 times as it has 10 times less the members in its set as set A, yet they're both equal because they're both infinite. You want to know how Bonaventure argued for this? It was lousy science, but it was a good argument. I adapted it to better science. Bonaventure lived at a time when man thought that the sun goes around the earth. Okay? And man was wrong at thinking the sun revolved around the earth, but he was right thinking that the moon went around the earth. And since the moon goes around the earth 12 times in 1 year, and he thought, Bonaventure and Aquinas and all the guys, the big thinkers of his day, thought that the sun went around the earth just once a year. Oh, yeah. Well, then how would it work? How do you figure it out? He put it down to the same time period. So, I think that's the Earth's rotation. Wasn't it the sun? Didn't they view the sun as going around the Earth?
The sky rotates around the Earth once a year.
Did they not think, though, that the sun went around the Earth once a year?
Because you could watch the sun go around the Earth once a day.
Isn't that the rotation?
They didn't know that.
But even with the Earth moving,
they thought that the Earth was stationary. Mm-hmm. The sun went around once a day, the moon once a month, and the entire sky.
Okay, well then, assuming that is what he said, I'll have to read up on it, because I thought it was a 12-to-1 ratio. I'll have to read up on it. It's right. It's in Coppleston's work on it. If that was the case, then what they would say is that for every 30 times that the moon goes around the earth, every
3,300 solar revolutions, you get one moon, or you get 12 moons.
Okay, we'll go with those numbers.
One for 30.
Okay, so say a 1-to-30 ratio. But if the universe was eternal, they would both have gone around just as many times, because they're both infinite. They both would have run around an infinite number of times, yet one went around the Earth 30 times more, or whatever it was. And so it's a contradiction. It just can't be true. And so he used that type of argumentation. Now, it's good philosophy. It was just bad science. Now, you could do the same with good science using something like the Earth. I don't know if it's Venus or there's one planet that goes around the sun. I don't know if it's like 3 times as fast or 3 times as slow as the Earth, and so you've got a nice easy ratio to deal with. And you could say that if the universe is eternal, then what you have is one planet went around the sun 3 times as many times as the other planet, yet they both went around as many times because they both went around an infinite number of times. So you end up, it generates absurdities, therefore you cannot have an actual infinite set in the concrete realm. Now, I mean, I don't want to get too deep on this, but you might have to just trust me on this. You can have an actual infinite set in the abstract realm in a mind. But since it's an actual infinite set, the only mind that it could exist in would be an infinite mind, okay? What cannot be done with an actual infinite set in the abstract realm, remember we've shown it's impossible to have an actual infinite set in the concrete, okay? The world of things outside, existing outside the mind. But in the mind, what can't be done, shown from Zeno's paradox and set A, set B, and set C that we've talked about, you can't traverse it. In other words, you could only know, if you were the infinite mind, you could only know that infinite set in one eternal glance. You could not know it one thought at a time, okay? Because if you went one thought at a time, what that tells us about eternity is that throughout all eternity we'll be learning more and more about God, but we'll never have Him totally figured out. Okay, and I'm kind of glad too, because there wouldn't be much left to do after that. Okay? Yeah.
What would you call us, an unnaturalized infinite God?
Us? An unnatural...
No, the actual infinite in God's mind is an actual infinite. It's an actual potential.
It's actualized in the eternal now. He knows it in one eternal glance. And we see it's kind of like we know when we say God is immaterial, we think, well, I've got a good idea what immaterial is. Well, I've never seen anything immaterial. I know what material things are, and I know that God is not that. And it's the same with God existing in the eternal now. We know what past, present, and future is, so we got some idea. We say, well, that's not the way God sees things in His essence. It's just one eternal glance. But it really, what it comes out, in other words, what we're saying is, we're saying we know enough about God in these areas to know that we don't know very much about Him in those areas. Okay? In other words, there's a point where the finite reaches out to the infinite, but doesn't fully grasp it. And obviously, there will never be the time where we fully comprehend God in an exhaustive sense. Now, I think with Aquinas's argumentation against the Kalam principle might have been based, that these guys, Bonaventure and Aquinas, might have been arguing apples and oranges. Aquinas might have really been arguing something more along the lines that if he would have seen his mistake, he would recognize, oh, that can only exist in a mind, and therefore in God's mind, because there has to be an infinite mind. But in other words, when Aquinas thought he was refuting Bonaventure, he might have been just refuting the premise that an actual infinite set of finites cannot exist. Well, the fact of the matter is it can exist, but only in the mind of God. Okay? See, an actual thing doesn't... If you have a thought, right now think about a palm tree in Hawaii. Okay? That's an actual thing. Okay? It's not a potential. If you really thought of that, that's an actual thing. But it's an actual thing that does not exist outside your mind. Okay? So, actuals can exist. When you talk about actual things can exist in the mind, but not out in the outside the mind. But when you say concrete and abstract, then it's very closely related to
actual and potential, but there you're splitting another hair, and you're saying that concrete is that which exists outside the mind, and abstract is that which exists only in the mind. Okay? So I hope we're not losing everybody in the in some of this terminology here. But if you turn back to Bonaventure, he's got good arguments. In other words, he's saying, okay, I'll give you a more simpler argument. Bonaventure used it much like this. Whatever had a beginning needs a cause. Now, obviously, if something had a beginning, it had to have a cause. Because from nothing, nothing comes. So something had to cause it to come into existence. So whatever had a beginning needs a cause. Then he argues the universe had a beginning. Here's another example he gives. If the universe didn't have a beginning, then there's an infinite number of moments that stretch back from now into the infinite past. The problem is, you would never reach the moment now, because you would have to cross an infinite number of moments to reach the moment now. You couldn't even reach the moment of creation. See, that's why Augustine argued that there was no time before time began. There was no time before creation, because time is change, and until the unchanging God created, even the word "until" is loaded with the idea of time. There you go. But Augustine argued that before God created the first changing things, there was no time. There was only eternity. Time is change. Now, I used to think time was a measurement of change, but Moreland straightened me out on that. Time actually is change itself. Okay, so the universe had a beginning, so we could not reach the present moment now if there was an infinite number of moments in the past, because you cannot traverse an infinite number of moments to reach the moment now. No matter how many moments you would have traversed, you still have an infinite number of moments to traverse more before you would reach the moment now. But we have reached the moment now, so that tells us that there had to be a first moment. And so the universe had to have a beginning. That's another way that he argued for it. And since the universe had a beginning, and whatever had a beginning needs a cause, therefore the universe needs a cause. But maybe whatever caused the universe to come into existence, maybe that had a cause. But the problem is, you can't go on infinitely like that. An infinite regress is impossible, for the same reason that the universe had to have a beginning. Therefore, the cause of the universe must be eternal, must be an eternal, uncaused cause. William Lane Craig is a modern proponent of that argument. Now, at this point, I don't want to just jump right into Old Testament reliability. If you guys have any questions about... Oh, in fact, we still got to go over... My argument here that I've got on AP 16 is not necessarily the argument that I use when I do debates. I simplify it more than this. But what I want to do is I want to show... It says this argument builds upon the work of the philosophers mentioned above. I just wanted to show that you can take a cosmological argument and add to it moral and teleological premises, and how you can fine-tune your argumentation to where God sounds more and more like the God of the Bible. The God of your argument, the conclusion of your argument, sounds more and more like the God of the Bible. I started out with point A: some dependent beings now exist. Point number one: I must exist in order to deny my existence. That's the principle of actual undeniability from Geisler. In other words, nothing is nothing, nothing can do nothing, therefore nothing can deny nothing. So if you deny your own existence, you have to exist, you have to actually exist in order to make the denial. So it's actually undeniable that I exist. And when I communicate with others, I affirm their existence. Okay? Point number three: I am dependent on many things for my continued existence, such as air, water, food, Point number four. Others live like dependent beings. You could use an argument like Charles Hodge would use, like the denial of dependency is forced and temporary. For instance, to deny that other dependent beings exist would, in essence, be a denial of the existence of the physical universe, the physical world. But the denial of the physical world is forced and temporary. What Charles Hodge means by that in his systematic theology, it's forced. In other words, it's like you forced the philosopher you were debating in the lecture hall, you forced him, because of the logic of his worldview, you forced him to state that he holds this position that the physical world doesn't really exist. You know, either you forced him or he forced himself, but it's forced. I mean, it's something where he doesn't want, he doesn't really believe that particular thing, but he has to say that he does in order to be consistent with the other beliefs that he doesn't want to give up. Okay? So it's forced, but it's also temporary. Because when that philosopher, that atheist philosopher, leaves that lecture hall, he gets into his car, which he recognizes that it exists, and he drives on the road, the highway, which he knows exists, and so he can't live like the physical world is non-existent. Okay? And that's why when I build my arguments for God's existence, I try to use premises that have to be assumed just for a guy to accept my challenge to debate. So that any time a guy tries to deny my conclusion, if my conclusion does follow logically from my premises, I ask him which one of my premises does he not like. And whichever premise he points to, as long as I stack the deck with premises that he has to assume in order to take the debate, you know, I got the guy in a contradiction. You know, what is he going to say, that things happen without a cause? When I debate an atheist, it's usually a guy, an atheist, who's really heavy into modern science and atheistic evolution. You can't deny that things accept that something might pop into existence without a cause and then still continue to do honest scientific research expecting to find the cause and effect relationship of things. But the denial of a lot of the premises that argue for God's existence, and sometimes all the premises in a good argument for God's existence, the denial of those premises is forced and temporary. And So I think from that first premise, some dependent beings now exist. I exist, and there's other dependent beings that exist as well. Point number two, from nothing, nothing comes. Nothing is nothing, therefore nothing does nothing, therefore nothing can cause nothing. Well, then that tells us that something must be eternal. Now, where do we get that? Well, it follows from the premise before it. Because if there was ever nothing existing, then there would be nothing right now. Okay? If there was ever in the past, anywhere in the past, if there was absolutely nothing, since from nothing, nothing comes, there would be nothing now. But since something now exists, something has to be eternal. Okay? Do you understand that premise? Now, what we have not proven, you can still be an atheist and agree to that premise. Because you can have an eternal universe. At least, you know, they could hope to have an eternal universe, okay? But we haven't gotten to that point yet. But something now exists. Some dependent beings now exist. That was point A. Therefore, something must be eternal. No beginning or end. Premise D. This eternal something cannot be the universe. Because if it was the universe, an eternal universe would mean an actual infinite set of finite events in the concrete realm. Okay, that's the one thing I left out there. In fact, I'm going to write that in my paper. in the concrete realm. In other words, existing outside the mind, okay? And so, an actual infinite set of finites is impossible. We went over that with the three sets. You would have a set of all odd and even numbers that runs on and on infinitely. That's an infinite set. But the set of just odd numbers is also an infinite set, yet it only has half the members of the other set. So how can it be have half the members but the same number of members? How can it be both equal and not equal at the same time in the same way? Violates the law of non-contradiction, and it tells us that an actual infinite set existing outside of an infinite mind is impossible. Point 5 under D, premise D, any view that generates contradictions and absurdities is false. If the universe is eternal, we could never reach the moment now. And it's impossible to traverse an actual infinite set of finite events. Zeno's paradox, that's the lesson learned from it, that it's impossible to traverse an actual infinite set of finite points. And so what that tells us is that philosophically, we haven't even argued at all from science, philosophically speaking, there had to be a first event. The universe had to have a beginning, okay? So the universe cannot be this eternal something. So we know that something must be eternal, but this eternal something cannot be the universe. Point number 5, this eternal something must be the uncaused cause of everything else that exists. Why? Because you only got two things that everything could come into existence from. Either nothing, and we know that from nothing, nothing comes, or from this eternal something. And so the dependent beings are caused by the eternal something. Okay? Premise F, there is intelligent and moral life in the universe. During my debate, what I argued in my opening statement on when I debated God's existence with Dr. Peter John at Lower Columbia College, I argued that there is intelligence in the universe, and that there's no way I stated too, I hope this debate is evidence of that, you know, that there is some intelligence in the universe. But there's no way to deny the existence of intelligence in the universe without without using intelligence, basically. Not using intelligence in a very intelligent manner, but you've got to use intelligence. Without intelligence, there could be no thought or communication. So just to communicate the idea that there is no intelligence takes intelligent thought. So it's actually undeniable, that as well. Point number 2, without morality, there could be no such thing as right and wrong. But we all recognize there is such a thing as right and wrong. Even Bertrand Russell recognized. Bertrand Russell was like you could pin him down, he was pretty much a moral relativist, but when you got right down to it, he called people's actions wrong. And he wanted to quote Father Copleston, their debate over God's existence. When it got to the point of the moral argument for God's existence, Copleston asked him if he thought Adolf Hitler was wrong, and he said yeah, he believed Adolf Hitler was wrong, but he believed he was wrong in the sense that a man is colorblind. You know, one man is colorblind and another man sees colors well. Well, pretty much is what he was getting at, but the thing was, Copleston couldn't pin him down as to whether or not Russell really believed in the existence of colors. Or, in other words, the colorblind guy might be right, and everybody else is wrong, you know, and there's no way. The only reason why we're convinced we call the colorblind guy colorblind is because he's in the minority. which it should be a lesson to atheists, because atheists, you know, like Sigmund Freud trying to say that we were suffering from neurosis, and that's why we invented God by wish fulfillment. Hey, if there's 95% of us, people who believe that some type of God exists, and there's only 5% of him, shouldn't he be the one with neurosis? Shouldn't we be considered the normal guys and him be considered? I mean, he's the guy that came up with the theory that that little boys grow up wanting to have sex with their mother. So maybe he was the weirdo and not us. So with Russell there in the debate with Cops, it's in John Hick's book, The Existence of God, by the way. It was real interesting because Russell didn't want to be pinned down to have to support any particular view. What he was basically trying to get from Russell, are you saying by bringing up this illustration of colorblind that Hitler likes vanilla ice cream and everybody else likes chocolate ice cream, and so he's the messed up one because killing innocent people is not the most popular thing? Is it a thing of, is it something that deals with just taste, subjective taste, or is there an objective more than that? Now, the problem for Russell was Russell wanted to say, yes, there is an objective moral law, that which is right and wrong, which is above all men. He wanted to say that, but he knew he couldn't, because he knew this young Jesuit priest, who's now, if he's still alive, he's about 100 years old now. He was still ticking a few years ago, but Toppleston, in fact, they both lived to be extremely old. Both lived well into their 90s. Russell knew that if he admitted to this moral law, objective moral law existing above all men, that all men were answerable to, well, what kind of law is it? It's not a descriptive law. Once you say it's a law that all men ought to obey, it's not a descriptive law like the laws of nature. It's a prescriptive law. It prescribes. It doesn't describe the way things are. It prescribes the way things ought to be. And the only kind of things that prescribe laws are prescribers of laws. In other words, a moral lawgiver. And so Russell couldn't say that. So, you know, he was just pretty much stuck in a position where he couldn't go one way or the other. But without morality, there could be no such thing as right and wrong. We all live like there is such a thing as wrong. Even the moral relativists are always protesting something is wrong. I mean, you get New Agers. There's no such thing as right and wrong. What's right for me is right for me. Doesn't have to be right for you, and vice versa. But then, there they are, protesting, you know, sitting down on train tracks, trying to block a train shipment of nuclear weapons onto a nuclear base. Then there they are, protesting, you know, testing perfumes on animals. You know, they're going out trying to save the whales. Hey, if there's no such thing as right and wrong, then there's nothing wrong with butchering whales for kicks. Okay? And I'm not saying we should do that. Although I will say this.
You're saying that they can't say they can't.
Yeah. That's just like, yeah, exactly. They can't say we can't, or they can't say we ought. Al Benet, my old cameraman, the atheist, he was telling me that moral values are relative. Okay, so what's right for me is right for me, doesn't have to be right for you, and it all comes from, it's subjective, each person decides what is right and wrong. He said, therefore, we should not outlaw abortion. And so I told him, I said, man, Al, you really messed up. And I told him, I said, man, you got a 4-year degree in psychology from San Diego State, didn't they teach you how to think? It's real clear. If there is no such thing as right and wrong, then you have no right to say they should not outlaw abortion, or they should not do this, or they should do that. The word should gets removed from your vocabulary. Ought, the word ought gets removed from your vocabulary. The way things ought to be, that don't exist, because there's no way things, the way things are, they just are. No distinction between right and wrong. And so, you know, I mean, all you got to do is pick up a book someday of a writer who holds to a moral relativist, and then just go through the book. Don't even read the book. Just go through and circle every time you see the word should or the word ought in there.
The word right or wrong.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. Or good or evil.
That's a good idea.
Yeah. Okay, so this eternal something must be the uncaused cause of everything else that exists. And since there is intelligent and moral life in the universe, intelligence and morality cannot come from nature, because nature is non-intelligent and non-moral. I mean, you don't get moral values from a mound of dirt. Okay? When C.S. Lewis used that in his moral argument for God's existence, and he also used it in his argument from reason for God's existence, so he used them both that way. It'd be like if we were arguing from reason. If you had a conclusion that followed directly from the premise before it, which followed directly, you know, followed logically from the premise before that, and followed logically from the premise before that, but then followed from the first, but then came from the first premise, which you didn't logically follow. And then in other words, suppose you argued premise number one, apples are green. Premise number two, all bachelors are single males. Premise number three, Socrates is a bachelor. Premise number four, therefore Socrates is a single male. Okay? You see how every one of them flows from it except that first one. So basically you would not have a valid argument, because your first premise, the second premise, doesn't flow from it. You make a non-rational jump to go from one to the other. Okay? Now, if you've got justification for that second premise and you get rid of the first one, you've got a valid argument. And so what C.S. Lewis is arguing is, say, if we say that we got intelligence from our parents, who got intelligence from our parents, who got intelligence from our parents, who got intelligence from eventually non-intelligent primordial soup, you've got the it doesn't rationally follow. Okay? You can't make that jump. And so, intelligence and morality cannot come from nature. Nature is non-intelligent, non-moral. Therefore, the eternal uncaused cause of everything else that exists must be an intelligent and a moral being, i.e. a personal being. As the source of all else that exists, this eternal uncaused cause must be unlimited in all its attributes. Okay, there's nothing else that could limit the existence of this eternal, uncaused, and, you know, totally independent being. He must be all-powerful because he is the source of all the power in the universe, and no other power can limit him. He must be all-knowing because he is the source of all knowledge. He must be sovereign because, as creator, he cannot be mastered by his creation. He must be all good because he is the source of all the good in the universe, and he is not limited by evil. He must be perfect because he is the standard by which all else is measured. He must be immaterial because he's not limited by matter. He must be everywhere present because he's not limited by space. He must be eternal because he's not limited by time. And this God must be one being, because two infinite beings would limit one another. But this would be impossible, since to be infinite means to be unlimited by any other being. Also, for two beings to differ, one being must have something that the other one lacks. But if one being lacks some perfection, then he cannot be infinite, because an infinite being must have every perfection infinitely. And so only one being can be infinite. And so all these things flow. By the way, what we're doing here is just, that's a summary of like about, probably about one third of Aquinas' Summa Theologica. I mean, that's the way he, when people look at his five ways to prove God's existence, that's not the whole story. That's just the tip of the iceberg. In fact, even the arguments there, he's just giving a summary of what he argued for at greater length in his writing against the pagans. Okay? But even if the arguments in the Summa Theologica, the five ways to prove God's existence, even if that was the most exhaustive he ever got there, which it wasn't, that's just the tip of the iceberg, because he hasn't even begun to start arguing for some of the different attributes of God, and to determine whether or not there's one God or many gods. And then point J, as the source of all finite existence, the eternal uncaused cause must be immanent, that means involved with his creation, and transcendent, separate from his creation. It must be immanent because he has to sustain all finite existence. He's the cause of its continuing existence. For what cannot cause its own existence cannot keep itself in existence. And he must be transcendent because he is infinite, and his creation is finite. He's unlimited, his creation is limited, and therefore he is not identical to the universe. He is transcendent, he is separate from it. I mean, when you look at all these attributes from an argument for God's existence, the Christian theist is standing on good, solid, rational ground. Like the empiricist who says truth can only be found through the five senses, and then he can't even prove that statement true by the five senses, it refutes so quick. When you look at Christian theism, all the problems that it solves, all the questions that it answers, and then every time the Christian theism or our idea of God has been objected to because it's contradictory, 5-10 years later, some other Christian philosopher comes on the scene and says, wait a minute, there's a fallacy in that in that atheistic argument. And in fact, I don't think there's been any argument that has been proposed to prove the Christian concept of God as incoherent that has been widely accepted by atheists today. Kai Nielsen tries to claim that our concept of God is incoherent, but he was real smart when he debated J.P. Moreland. He didn't explain what he meant by incoherent until the very end of the debate, so that Moreland couldn't slam him on it. And basically what he's saying is it's impossible to be both transcendent and immanent. And it's not. All you have to do is say, well, my concept of transcendent and immanent is that God is separate from the universe, but he's involved with it. He sustains it in existence, and he can intervene at any time he chooses, but he is transcendent in that he is not identical to the universe. He is separate from it. He is above it. He is unlimited, and the universe is limited. There's no contradiction there whatsoever. There's nothing incoherent about that whatsoever. And that was Kai Nielsen's whole argument, which means he really had no argument. Basically, any argument that they bring up that supposedly disproves God's existence, usually it's just a newer form of some older argument that was refuted by Augustine or Aquinas hundreds of years ago. So there's really, we don't need to have lie awake at night wondering if our faith is going to be destroyed. We know enough about God's truth. It's just like the apostles when Jesus turned to the apostles after he fed the 5,000 people, and he fed the 5,000 people. And then he told them that he spoke symbolically to them, told them you had to eat my body and drink my blood if you want to have eternal life. they thought he was talking about cannibalism, so they all upped and left. But he wanted to test them to see how serious, how committed they were to him. And they, it turned out they were only superficially committed to him. They were going to stick around so long as he put food in their belly. But once he started talking strange stuff, they didn't want nothing to do with it. Well, Jesus then turned to his apostles and said, "You guys don't want to split too, do you?" And Peter turned to him and said, "Where are we going to go? You alone have the words of eternal life." See, what Peter was saying, look, in Peter's mind, he probably thought, "Jesus, you really blew it here. I mean, you preached, you had the biggest crowd you ever had, and then you preached the worst message of your ministry, and you just sent them all home. So, I mean, you really blew it. It could have been real great, but hey, as far as we're concerned, you're it. We put all our eggs in one basket. We're totally committed to you. You've answered enough of our questions about eternal matters to where if you preach a message that the world hates and we don't understand, we can live with that question mark." Same with the book of Job. Job was saying, hey, God said Job was blameless. Job was blameless, so you want to pick on somebody, Satan, pick on him. Job is suffering then because Satan's picking on him, and he turns to his friends and says, "Hey, I didn't do anything wrong. Maybe God keeps bad records. I want to plead my case before God." Job's friends were a bunch of health and wealthers. They said, "Hey, look, if you're suffering, you must have done something wrong. You must be a sinner." Well, then God comes on the scene and basically tells us, "Job, where were you when I created you?" He tells him, "Offer sacrifice for your friends," because they were off the wall. They were out to lunch. But he says, "Job, don't question the way I keep records. Don't try to come to trial with me. Where were you when I created the universe? Where were you when I made Leviathan? Where were you when I made Behemoth? You can't control those beasts, yet I created them." And so what he's basically saying is, "Look, Job, you know enough about my goodness not to question me in areas that you just don't understand, such as why does God allow the innocent to suffer?" And that's the way I am with arguments for God's existence. Whenever some new atheist comes up on the scene, supposedly has an argument to disprove God's existence, hey, God has proven enough things about himself real to me at this point to where, you know, if he's provided 999 solutions to 999 problems, if there's one problem that I can't reconcile, that's not going to cause me to join the 5,000. I'll stay with Peter because I put all my eggs in one basket, but for good reason. And same with Peter. I mean, this dude Jesus was raising the dead. So he had good reason to stick with Jesus even when he didn't understand the message. I mean, he just miraculously fed 5,000 people and they walked off. So maybe there's people that want to be atheists because they can't understand the reconcile the problem of evil or whatever. The fact of the matter is, our God has given us more than enough evidence, and I don't think there's anything that we need to fear. And to be honest with you, it's been I don't ever recall any of the debates I've ever listened to between atheists and Christians, and the debates that I've taken part in. I don't think the atheists ever, or they call themselves agnostics now because they admit their case isn't strong enough to call it atheism, but I've yet to see an atheist scholar give a Christian scholar even put up a fight with him when the question was God's existence. Okay, does anybody have any questions at all? Well, I think what we'll do, rather than start it right now, we'll just start Old Testament reliability next week. Any questions at all? Now, on the test, I'm not going to require you to give me back everything that we covered, but you are going to have to be able to recognize what the cosmological argument is. And even in its three forms, know that Aquinas used existential causality, Leibniz, sufficient reason, Bonaventure, the Kalam cosmological argument, but be able to define what the cosmological argument is. And even be able to give a simplified form of it, that the universe, everything that has a beginning needs a cause, the universe had a beginning, therefore the universe needs a cause. But Kalam one there would be pretty easy. Be able to define the teleological argument. And in fact, it's just the way I've got them there in point one on the evidence for God's existence. Cosmological, teleological, moral, religious experience, and ontological argument. Be able to identify all the guys' names that are here, other than mine and Shay Schaefer's. You won't need that either for that particular point. You will need that for the section we did on Schaefer. But it's not gonna be real advanced. But I do want you guys to come out with a good working knowledge of these different arguments for God's existence. By the way, at this point, we're leaving philosophical apologetics and we're moving into historical apologetics. And the way modern man thinks, we think more in the concrete realm than we do in the abstract realm. So most people like historical apologetics a lot more. When we get to Old Testament reliability, we're going to argue that Moses did write the first five books of the Bible. We're going to argue that there was only one Isaiah who wrote the complete book of Isaiah. We'll argue that Daniel really did write Daniel when the conservative scholars date it. And that type of thing. And those are important questions, important issues to deal with, because the critical scholars are trying to claim that the Bible was just a bunch of legends put together by a bunch of different guys at different times and different places. And it really wasn't, really doesn't tell us the true story about Moses and about God parting the Red Sea and a worldwide flood and things like that. It's just a bunch of myths. By the way, if you ever compare the biblical account of the worldwide flood with the Babylonian account, you'll see the difference between truth and a myth. The dimensions of the ark would be almost, make it, the heavier you loaded it down with, the harder it would be to capsize.